Good morning. I call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. It's Wednesday, April 15th, 2026. We have a quorum present. First, a reminder about our committee rules. Signs are not permitted in the committee room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, applause, or other disruptions are not allowed. Sitting or standing in the aisles is not permitted, and the State Patrol and House Security staff are present to ensure everyone's safety. If you leave the committee room, please hang on to your tickets to re-enter the room. We have a full agenda today, so we'll be limiting testimony to 2 minutes. Thank you all for your attention and participation in this committee's work. First order of business is approval of the minutes from Monday, April 13th, 2026. Representative Carroll, would you be willing to approve those minutes?
Absolutely. It's an honor, Chair. In fact, I do move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Carroll. Any discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? And the minutes from Monday, April 13th are approved. First up on the agenda today is House File 4401 from Vice Chair Ryer. Vice Chair Ryer, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Ryer moves her bill, House File 44, before the committee to be laid over. Vice Chair Ryer, I understand you have the D3 amendment. Would you move and explain the amendment, please?
Yes, I move the D3 amendment. It gets the bill in the shape that I would like, implementing rate recommendations.
Vice Chair Ryer moves adoption of the DE3 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Ryer, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and committee members. Last year, about this time, we heard House File 1934. This bill changed the timeline for adopting the single dental administrator from January 1, 2026 to January 1, 2028. This was passed to protect the stability of the safety net dental system and help avoid a breakdown in access to care for Medicaid and Minnesota Care members. House File 4401 takes the next step. It implements the dental payment rate structure that the recommendation was required in House File 1934. Since the end of the last session, the Dental Access Workgroup has been meeting to discuss the rate structure. The recommendations included getting the fee schedule and rates caught up, and then also putting processes in place to ensure that they don't fall behind again. The group agreed that the dental fee schedule should be updated to 2024 submitted charges. This is an update from 1989 submitted charges. The rate methodology should be updated every 2 years. This would help ensure that dental rates continue to reflect ongoing changes in the delivery of care. The rates should be set at 50% of the 50th percentile of 2024 charges, with an inflationary factor included in the updated rate methodology to maintain the rates in the years when the methodology isn't being updated. And then the existing rate add-on of 20% for critical access dental providers should be maintained. This is intended to be budget neutral. A fiscal note has been requested, and after this is laid over, any potential fiscal issues will be discussed and addressed. The approach to implementing the single dental administrator we passed in 2025 had bipartisan support from this committee's GOP and DFL chairs and co-chairs. And the proposal you've just heard was developed with a robust group of stakeholders with the goal of protecting the stability of the critical access dental network in Minnesota and the Medicaid members who depend on them for their dental care. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ryer. We'll now move to testifiers, and we have Mr. Dan Murphy, Director of Government Affairs, Minnesota Dental Association. Please make yourself comfortable, state your name for the committee, and proceed.
Co-chairs Backer and Bierman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity today. My name is Dan Murphy with the Minnesota Dental Association, and for the sake of time, I'll be brief. There are some written comments in your packets, but I just wanted to take this opportunity today to say a few words. First, as Representative Ryer stated, Minnesota's fee-for-service dental rates currently are based on 1989 charges, and even though there's been incremental updates over time, it has not kept pace with costs today. And the impact is clear. When it comes to fee-for-service rates as a percentage of adult or average dentist charges, Minnesota ranks 37th out of 43 states in the District of Columbia that have an adult dental benefit, and 45th in the nation for pediatric reimbursement. And this obviously significantly Minnesota lags behind national averages. And as you know, as Representative Ryer mentioned, last year the legislature delayed implementation of the administrative model until 2028. Even though the single administrator model would default for fee-for-service rates, or ultimately whatever is set in law, as Representative Ryer said, that this is step one of many to address that issue. I'd also strongly encourage the committee, whether it's today or in future sessions, to build off of this proposal and continue to invest in dental reimbursement for Minnesota healthcare programs. The number one reason that dentists hesitate to participate is reimbursement. And so even with additional investment, hopefully the low rankings I mentioned will continue to be a thing of the past. And finally, I want to emphasize that the rate structure in this bill would apply for fee-for-service rates regardless of when the single administrator transition would occur. While they're obviously connected, this bill stands on its own, and I ask for your support today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to discussion of the bill from members. Representative Nadeau, Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Ryer. Maybe Dan can come back. I'm kind of curious about the if the work group that we put into place has completed its work and made recommendations. That's my first question. And the second question is if this bill were theoretically to pass, and I recognize it's being laid over, but what would be, I don't remember what the rate structure is now. It's like 98% of the 1989 rates or something like that. What would be the impact to dental providers if we were to be able to pass this?
Mr. Murphy, did you catch both those questions?
Yes, Chair Bierman, Vice Chair Nadeau. The work group, which includes our association and many other dental stakeholders, is still ongoing. There's still a lot of other items to address. And that work is continuing, and the rates were the first part of that group, which results in this bill here today. Your second question is a very good question. This, as mentioned, is step one to get those base rates caught up to current charges. But beyond that, we believe further investment is needed for this transition to be successful, because obviously, not just your private practice dentists, but also the critical access dental providers, their financial infrastructure really needs to be maintained as that goes forward. So I don't have a specific number for you, but we do need further investment. But this is step one in order to get to that point.
Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair. I would just add that the intent of the cost-neutral aspect of the bill is that the reimbursement that goes from managed care companies to the providers at this point would be brought into that, so it wouldn't be dividing up simply the fee-for-service. It would be doing as much as possible to hold dental providers where they are.
Vice Chair Nadeau, follow-up?
No, thank you.
Okay. Closing comments, Vice Chair Ryer.
No, thank you. I'm glad to have this laid over so we can keep the conversations going.
Vice Chair Ryer renews the motion that House File 4401 as amended be laid over, and the bill is laid over. Next, we will hear House File 4466, the Health Supplemental Budget Bill. I will sit and remain here for this procedure, and we have our staff right here as well. So I will move that House File 4466 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Before we move the DE1 amendment, we'll have a walkthrough from nonpartisan staff of the spreadsheet and the DE. Starting with the spreadsheet, Ms. Stern, if you could proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to direct your attention to a document in your packet. It's on a legal 8.5 by 14. In the top left corner, it should say House Health Finance, 2026 legislative session, and then the bill number, which is intended House File 4466, as amended by the DE. And as I'm walking through the spreadsheet, pay particular attention to the columns to the right of the spreadsheet, because that is where the changes for the bill. Is that better? Thank you. Getting started, on line 5, you'll see that the overall impact of the bill to the general fund appropriations in FY27 is a savings of $2,442,000 for the 26-27 biennium and a total savings of $697,696,000 in the next biennium. Moving down to line 17, this is the section where we summarize the changes to the MA forecast, and all of the savings in this agreement is savings tied to HR1 provisions, and I'll go into further detail. But you should note on line 23 that a large part or the overwhelming majority of the savings comes from the adults without children population, and that's tied to provisions in the HR1. Just to summarize the two department totals on line 26, the Department of Human Services, all of the general fund savings in the bill accrues, and again, this is related to HR1, and I'll go into detail below here. And then on line 55, there are a number of MDH, or Department of Health provisions, that are cost neutral. There is one provision that does have an increase for this biennium of about $867,000 in this biennium and $851,000 in the next biennium. So getting into the real substance of the changes in the bill, you'll see starting on line 102 and following into the next page down through line 131 are provisions related to compliance. We know Vice Chair Nadeau had two bills on these federal compliance changes, and should be House File 3439 and House File 3763. And the governor also had budget recommendations for this. And a lot of the information is a mixture of both policy decisions and fiscal decisions that are itemized here. And I'll talk through what those are, but they relate to work requirements and community engagement requirements for adults without children population, and also 6-month renewals for that population. But the key decision point with the largest financial impact, you'll see on lines 104 to 106, are related to retroactive eligibility for MA. In current law, when an individual applies for MA, they are eligible for 3 months of retroactive eligibility, but both Vice Chair Nadeau and the governor's recommending shortening this retroactive eligibility to 1 month for the adults without children population and 2 months for all other groups. So you can see on the far right, for those three columns, savings of roughly $15.9 million in this biennium and $136 million in the next biennium. Turning to the second page, I won't go line by line for all of the other provisions, but I will say that they are reflective of additional needs for FTEs to implement work requirements and the 6-month renewals for communications with local partners, for data contracts, I'm required to do eligibility determinations, IT systems upgrades, and communications. On line 123, there is another governor's rec and has provisions similar to Representative Nadeau's, and the three kind of major pieces are on line 125, the reinstatement of cost sharing in FY29. You can see that the governor recommended and the agreement allows for cost sharing to begin for that adults without children population starting in 29, and that would bring increased revenue in 29 by $411,000. There's also some additional IT, state IT costs, and also a provision for additional FTE dedicated to partnering with counties and focusing very keenly on trying to reduce error rates in eligibility determinations, because there are new penalty provisions in federal law. Moving on to the next section, Department of Health, the on line 131, the all payer claims database fee schedule. This was a governor's rec that the committee or the agreement included that is for increasing the availability of this data for non-MDH researchers. And so this approved an increase in appropriation of $187,000 roughly in 27 and to $233,000 per year in following years. And the revenue to increase, the fee revenue to increase in tandem to match. On line 131, the HMO fee appropriation, this was I believe a 2025 revenue, a revenue increase was approved, but the corresponding appropriation was not, and so this was a recommendation to include the authority to spend the additional revenue that was generated for this purpose. I will say that this is a contingent appropriation. The governor has an additional recommendation in the Commerce Committee that would, for a long time, MDH and Commerce have had an agreement to do, or that MDH would do the HMO regulatory activities and has, I believe, 15 FTE or 15 staff that are paid for through the general fund and the state government special revenue fund. But the governor's bill recommends that these activities be streamlined with the Department of Commerce. And it's unclear at this point if that will be fully taken up, but if that does occur, then this increase in appropriation would not go into effect, because those that money would then flow to the Department of Commerce. Line 131 is another no-cost provision. The recommendation was to codify the language about newborn screening fee exception. Turning to the last page on line 131, another no-cost provision. Simply modifying the descriptions of the different workforce shortage grants and giving more detail about eligibility. On line 131 is another fix from the 2025 session that was approved last year. The recommendation, I believe the appropriation was such that it didn't allow for admin costs for the competitive grants that they issue, so this would allow part of the appropriation that was originally appropriated to be used for admin. And you can see the increase to the admin and reduction, corresponding reduction to the grant. So a net zero up impact. Last two here on line 131, the healthcare loan forgiveness and fund extension. This simply clarifies that the loan appropriation that is provided for these grants does not cancel, and that it would be the funds are available until they are expended, in keeping in line with like the grant cycle that the agency does. And then finally, there's a Representative Hewitt bill on modifying licensure for reciprocal licensure, I believe, with other states. The MDH believes that due to this, that there will be an increase in licensures from folks coming from out of state, and there would be a revenue increase of roughly $13,000 per year. And, Mr. Chair, that is the happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Stern. And we will take questions if there are any questions right now for Ms. Stern from House Fiscal. Seeing none, we will then move to a walkthrough of the bill itself with Ms. Clarkvist and Ms. Mock. Who would like to go first? Ms. Clarkvist will go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be providing a high-level overview of the DE amendment. I'm going to be using the document. It's a House research document, and at the top it reads House File 4466 DE1 Amendment, List of Bills Included. And I'll be beginning with Article 1, which starts on page 1 of the DE and its health-related licensing boards. In Article 1, Sections 1 and 7 to 22 are from House File 3756, and they define covered insulin for purposes of the Insulin Safety Net Program and the manufacturer registration fee. Also in that article are Sections 2 to 6. They're from House File 2689, the first engrossment. And these modify provisions governing the supervision of student physical therapists and student physical therapist assistants for purposes of the practice of physical therapy. And that's it for Article 1. Next, I'll move to Article 2, which is Department of Health. And that starts on page 14 of the DE. Sections 1 and 2 of Article 2 are from House File 4968, which is the Health Department's appropriations bill, a governor's bill. And these sections establish fees to access data sets and files from the all-payer claims database for purposes of healthcare research. Sections 3 and 4 are from House File 4712, as amended. And these sections allow a homeowner to conduct certified swimming classes in the homeowner's private residential pool. Section 5 is from House File 4968. And this section establishes a process to exempt individuals from the newborn screening program fees at the Health Department. Section 6 is from House File 4968. And this section provides that appropriations for the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program do not cancel and are available until expended. Section 7 is from House File 4968. And this section provides that appropriations for the Home and Community-Based Services Employee Scholarship and Loan Forgiveness Program do not cancel and are available until expended. Sections 8 through 10 are from House File 4968. And these sections make changes to the Advanced Practice Provider Clinical Training Expansion Grant Program and to the Rural and Underserved Clinical Rotations Grant Program. Sections 11 to 14 are from House File 4968. And these sections make changes to the Rural Primary Care Residency Training Program. Sections 15 to 17 are from House File 4968, and these sections provide that appropriations for the International Medical Graduates Assistance Program do not cancel and are available until expended. And they also make changes to the International Medical Graduates Clinical Preparation Grant Program. Sections 18 through 20 are from House File 85. And these modify requirements for participation in mortuary science internships. Section 21 is from House File 84. And this section modifies requirements for the issuance of reciprocal licenses to practice mortuary science. And sections 22 to 24 are from House File 3804. And these sections extend the time period that a natural organic reduction facility may hold a deceased individual before initiating natural reduction. And that's the end of Article 2, and Ms. Mock will continue.
Thank you, Ms. Clarkvist. Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start with Article 3, which is federal conformity and related provisions. This starts on page 34 of the DE1. So Section 1 and Sections 20 through 22 are included in both House File 4428 and House File 3763. These establish data sharing requirements between DHS and DEED and DHS and DOR for purposes of administering the MA work or community engagement requirements. I will note that House File 3763 was heard in this committee. House File 4428 is a clone that was heard by the Judiciary Committee yesterday. Sections 2 and 3 and Section 18 are from House File 4969. They make technical changes to the state's hospital directed payment program, which is a program that was established in last year's legislature. Section 4 is also from House File 4969. It directs the DHS commissioner to obtain and use information from certain sources like managed care plans and the National Change of Address database to update contact information for MA and Minnesota Care enrollees. And this is part of federal conformity with HR 1. Section 5 is from House File 4969. And it caps the home equity limit for MA eligibility for long-term care at $1 million starting in 2028. This is also related to federal conformity. Sections 6 and 7 and Section 13 were both in House File 3439 and House File 4969. And these limit retroactive eligibility for medical assistance, as Ms. Stern described, and again, this is related to federal conformity with HR 1. Sections 8 and 9 were also in House File 3439 and House File 4969, and these are again related to federal conformity, requiring MA expansion enrollees or adults without children to renew their eligibility in MA every 6 months. Section 10 was in House File 3763 and also in House File 4969, and this establishes the work or community engagement requirements that were included in HR 1. Section 19 was only in House File 4969, and it makes expansion enrollees, those who are required to comply with the work requirements, it makes them ineligible for Minnesota Care if they do not comply with the work requirements. Section 11 is from House File 3439, and this directs DHS to review the death master file at least quarterly to identify any MA enrollees who are deceased. This is also part of federal conformity. Section 12 is from House File 3439 and was also in House File 4969, and this is also related to federal conformity, and it modifies non-citizens' eligibility for medical assistance. So only non-citizens who are lawful permanent residents, Cuban or Haitian entrants, or lawfully residing in the U.S. under a compact of free association would be eligible for MA. Sections 14 through to 17 are from House File 4969. They establish cost-sharing requirements for MA expansion enrollees, or those adults without children, and those would go into effect October 1, 2028. This is also related to federal conformity. Section 23 is from House File 4969. It requires that MMB consult with the DHS commissioner when adjusting the provider tax. This isn't directly related to federal conformity, but isn't explicitly required for federal conformity, but is related to the changes in HR 1 related to provider taxes. And Section 24, there's an incorrect reference here on your bill index. It should be, it comes from House File 3439. And this directs DHS to notify MA expansion enrollees that they may be eligible for MA under a disability determination. So that's the end of Article 3. I'll move to Article 4, which starts on page 61. The language here comes from House File 4547, and it just adjusts the appropriations for the forecasted programs that are administered by DHS to conform with the February forecast. Article 5, which starts on page 62, does the same thing, but it's for the programs administered by the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And then the last two articles are appropriation articles that Ms. Stern already walked through, and that's the bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Mock. Next, I'll move the adoption of the DE-1 amendment. But before we vote, we'll first hear testimony and secondary amendments to the DE. So we'll begin with testifiers. The first two up would be Mr. Andrew Knox and Mr. Dana Bacon. please make yourself comfortable. And Mr. Knox, if you could introduce yourself for the committee for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chairman Nadeau and committee members.
Maybe a little closer to the microphone, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nadeau and committee members. My name is Andrew Knox. I represent Legal Aid, and we represent clients who are low-income, disability, and elderly Minnesotans. I'm here to testify on the Minnesota work requirements in this bill, and first, work requirements that were passed by H.R. 1 will have devastating consequences on our clients. Looking at this bill, we have major concerns about some of the structural challenges in this bill. First, when reading the exemptions, you'll see that the exemptions conflict with Minnesota's Medicaid program and therefore causing some confusion. By not limiting the exemptions to individuals who fall under the definition, it could be interpreted as extending the work requirements to individuals who cannot fall under the definition in the first place. One example is having parents with children under 13, for example, as an exemption may be seen as actually expanding it to parents who have children from 14 to 18, the way this bill is structured. Another structural issue that we found is that this bill allows for 45 days prior to application, which we're not sure if that means a person has to then comply with 120 hours of community service or if they have to comply with 80 hours within the 45 days. It also makes it even more challenging when you think about the hardship exemptions, which gives you a month of compliance, but then do you have to finish the other 15 days of compliance? And how many numbers does that include? Since there's nothing in the bill that actually addresses per day how many hours are required. By changing the 1 month retroactive changing retroactive coverage from 3 months to 1 month, along with having a longer than 30-day application period, would mean that individuals who are applying for Medicaid would have to work while not being covered by insurance, and therefore would lead to more uncompensated care and probably more costs to the hospitals and their systems. And finally, we have an issue with the language that would remove people from eligibility for Minnesota care for non-compliance, mainly because we don't believe that this provision is necessary. In order to be on Minnesota care, the lower limit is 133% of poverty, which is $1,800. In order to comply, you only have to make $580. So there's no person who would be in non-compliance of these work requirements and still be eligible for Minnesota care anyway. So we don't feel that this should be in the bill at all, just in case something were to happen like what happened in Georgia when they put in their work requirements. We might need to change Minnesota care in order to be a safety net for individuals in a future date. So we'd rather not close the door on that option by including that language. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knox. Mr. Bacon, please introduce yourself for the committee.
Good afternoon, members. Co-Chair Bierman, my name is Dana Bacon. I'm here on behalf of Blood Cancer United, which used to be the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'd like to cover three things and make it quick. Two of them are things that are in the bill. One of them is a thing that is not. The two things that the bill does take up that I'd like to call out, first, it's in Article 3, Section 10, Sub 2. The letter we submitted for the record also gets into this in considerable detail, but I'd like to just call members' attention to the question of medical frailty and to ensure that as this legislation continues to move forward, that you continue to put getting these definitions right. Cancer patients do not have linear experiences in terms of survivorship. Sizes, shapes vary. So being able to develop a system that gauges medical frailty accurately and fairly is really important to the people I serve. The second thing I'd like to point out, again, this is something that is in the legislation, concerns the all-payer claims databases. Article 2, Sections 1 and 2. I can tell you from personal experience, having worked with researchers in Minnesota who care about access to care, being able to draw upon state data from Minnesota is an asset to us as a society. The researcher I worked with had to go use Colorado's payer claims database because it was up to the standards they needed. Seeing us continue to make our data more available while respecting privacy is valuable for research on so many levels and serves us well. The one thing that isn't in this bill that I'd like to point out, I had a pleasant surprise this morning watching the Senate HHS hearing and learning that they are setting aside money for eventual language for fertility coverage in their bill. That's an issue that impacts 1 in 6 Minnesotans, the people I work for. When you get cancer care as a young adult or child, you may well lose your fertility with that care. So having insurance coverage that provides protection for family building is really valuable, and I'd urge you to keep that issue in mind, knowing that this is a work in progress. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bacon. Next up, we'll have Ms. Michelle Benson and Sarah Lopez. Please make yourself comfortable and introduce yourself for the committee record and proceed with your testimony, Ms. Benson. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, members of the committee, I'm Michelle Benson. And on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. We appreciate efforts to maintain federal financial participation in medical assistance, aligning with key federal requirements under H.R. 1 helps assure continued matching dollars that are essential for our MA population. At the same time, we recognize proposals such as 6-month redetermination and work requirements add significant barriers to healthcare coverage. The Minnesota Hospital Association is committed to patient access to care. Our hospitals provide care for every person who walks through our door, regardless of their ability to pay. But you know that we cannot stay open, provide care, if we do not receive reimbursement for the care we provide. That is why we are concerned about provisions in this bill that shorten retroactive eligibility timelines for medical assistance. Under current law, hospitals have a reasonably short window to complete enrollment even as we deliver care. We incur costs while we work on enrollment. The changes proposed here would shrink that window dramatically. Hospitals would have only a few weeks to gather complex patient financial documents, get them through a county process, even as the patient or family works through hospitalization. We have to navigate processes that may differ in 87 counties and then hope enrollment is improved by the time our patient in a timely manner so that we can receive payment. Sorry, members. Let me share a real-world example that illustrates human and financial stakes. Consider an MA-eligible family whose newborn requires care in the NICU. While the family is focused on their medically fragile infant, the hospital staff must simultaneously work with county caseworkers to complete enrollment paperwork. The procedures, wait times, and backlogs vary dramatically from county to county. One of our most efficient counties, the backlog is 45 days. In some counties, the backlog stretches up to 2 months. One of our member hospitals recently reported more than 1,600 babies and children, many of them newborns, waiting more than 30 days for enrollment, representing $24 million in care that could not be timely billed. Hospital staff have no visibility into case progress and so must call and wait on hold to receive answers. There is no statewide standardization, no consistent escalation process, no ability to prioritize enrollment for care that has already been delivered. These delays are not abstract. Hospitals absorb mounting costs day after day while our staff spend hours on the phone chasing paperwork across overwhelmed counties. We appreciate this committee's commitment to modernizing and streamlining the enrollment system. However, an efficient process feels distant while our hospitals are providing care and in financial crisis today. As you know, hospitals are already operating with hospitals are already operating under financial pressure. More than 30% are operating at a loss. The 340B program is rapidly diminishing from the high water mark of $1.3 billion. New employer mandates make it harder every day to maintain adequate staffing. Our hospitals are starting the process of developing next year's budgets. The budgets will be finalized before you come back next session. As you make budget decisions this year, consider the stability you could provide to our hospitals. Shortening retroactive eligibility will leave hospitals with more uncompensated care, fewer resources, and tougher budget decisions. We respectfully ask that you remove language that eliminates existing retroactive eligibility. Doing so will protect access for patients, support hospital sustainability, and ensure that the care we deliver today can be reimbursed tomorrow. Thank you for your consideration. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Next up, Sarah Lopez, if you could introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Lopez, and I'm Policy Director at Unidos Minnesota. We really appreciate that many legislators from both parties have expressed regret about the way HR 1 restricts healthcare funding and eligibility. Minnesota now faces critical decisions about how to implement HR 1 in a way that prevents harm. I'm here to share our concerns with the proposed bill, which includes draconian restrictions on Medicaid eligibility for lawfully present immigrants. And these are set to take effect October 1st. As discussed in last month's hearing, House File 3763, many legal immigrants who previously qualified for Medicaid will lose eligibility overnight due to overly punitive changes in immigration criteria. This is a scapegoat and a distraction, and it will not make healthcare work for everyone. As the newly ineligible individuals for federally funded Medicaid include those granted asylum or withholding removal, refugees, survivors of domestic violence, survivors of trafficking with a pending or approved T visa or continued presence, individuals paroled into the U.S. for a period of at least 1 year, individuals granted conditional entry, individuals granted Iraqi or Afghan special immigrant visas and certain Afghan people, certain Ukrainian parolees, and American Indians born in Canada or members of a federal tribe who do not have another eligible status. This ugly scapegoat is not going to make our premiums more affordable or more accessible. This is a draconian new standard on legal immigrants and a clear example of how we erode constitutional rights on the backs of those pursuing the American dream the right way. And my question is, on which side are we on? This bill carves these harmful now distinctions into state law, crossing out refugees, asylees, victims of sex trafficking, and many more on pages 4950 of the DE-1. But the federal orders may continue to come in worse and in more unpredictable ways. Please, please work with DHS to implement the federal changes in ways that are less harmful and disruptive, not only for immigrants, but for Native American communities. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lopez. Do any other members of the public wish to testify? Seeing none, we will move to Representative Elkins. I understand you have the A1 amendment to the DE. Would you like to move and explain your amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. The DE1 amendment would add a general fund appropriation of $55,000 to the bill to enable the Department of Health to incorporate data about denied claims to the state all-payer claims database, which is the state's primary health policy research database. We already heard Mr. Bacon earlier testify as to the value of the database. We spent an inordinate amount of time here debating, speculating about whether or not denied claims is a problem, and if it's limited to certain kinds of carriers, procedures, providers, or reasons, this would give us the information that we need in order to make an objective evaluation of those policy questions. This amendment was part of a larger APCD improvement bill that also included the provision that the department did include in the bill, which has been discussed So this just puts the other half of that bill, which was House File 1487, into this as well. The department was not allowed to include this in their bill because it would render the bill non-revenue neutral, which was a requirement. But I have both Stefan Gildemeister and Kristen Acker who tell me that they're authorized to say that they're enthusiastically neutral about this position. They're nodding.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I wonder if we could have the department come up and comment a little bit further on that. If you'd state your name for the committee, please, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Stefan Gildemeister, I direct the Health Economics Program at the Department of Health. I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you. Mr. Gildemeister, I guess the question we had, or I have, is, so this has a slight cost, and could you go over the benefits for the Department of Health if we implement this and the need for it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so this is not an administration proposal, but it is a tool, as Representative Elkins said, that would tell us more about which claims were denied and give us some reason for why they were denied. I think there are opportunities to ask, to consider questions of access, to consider questions of insurance oversight, and also the administrative process involved with approving claims. So it's a puzzle piece of the broader picture of healthcare spending and the cost of administration. It's a one-time cost associated with setting up the system to collect that information from payers.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. And this is something that legislators have been asking you for this data in the past, and we just don't have it. So this would give a better insight into these denials by essentially providers and insurance companies, correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Gildemeister? Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this applies to the author of the amendment or Meister. Does this bill, as written, does it apply the same denial rate request data to DHS for the fee-for-service population, or is it limited only to managed care?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, if the representative wishes to answer first.
It would, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, sorry, Mr. Representative Nadeau, this would apply to all data coming into the into the all-payer claims database, the regular submissions, which is all insurance carriers, includes Medicare and Medicaid data as well.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Thank follow-up? You. No follow-up? All right. Any further discussion? Oh, here we are. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I received a text from someone who I will not name, but this is their question, and I just want to see, Mr. Gildemeister, how you would respond to this. The person says that what is in the bill, in the DE here, is selling our health data to the highest bidder. And I don't think that's correct. And but I would just like you to respond to that for the benefit of another member who is viewing it in that way.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the language that this bill adds, so we're not we're referring to the governor's component of the budget bill, is implementing a provision that the legislature passed in 2023, and there the legislature directed MDH to establish a fee schedule and a process for making these data available for services that are in the public interest in Minnesota. So that is the original language. Since that language has passed, we've been advised that we need the fee schedule in statute and the authority to take in fees from sharing these data for approved research purposes. So the process really is not about anyone getting the data, but rather about targeted use of the data to analyze opportunities for better understanding the healthcare system, identifying opportunities for system transformation, creating affordability, processing, as Mr. Bacon said, our understanding of healthcare burden. So we will be working with an advisory group that is charged to ensure that the approved research activities further Minnesotans' interest.
Any follow-up? Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And just for comfort for anyone who might not be familiar, Mr. Gildemeister, could you just sort of state in what form the data is? In other words, this is not identified data. How does this come to people? What are they seeing when they get this data?
Mr. Gildemeister?
Representative Liebling. The data is by statute de-identified, so we don't collect information on names or addresses, etc. To what extent a researcher sees granular data really depends on the data use agreement that will be established in practice and the need for certain data elements for their research. So, for example, best practice in data research is to limit data to minimally necessary information. So if somebody is doing aggregate information on a condition, the file that we will cut for them will be limited to that. The best practice is how we've been pursuing this work with our own staff and in partnership with others. So minimal information that identifies essentially care was provided, what diagnosis was available, what procedure was provided, and the price for the care, as well as the billing and service providing physicians. So it is de-identified information.
Yeah.
Another follow-up?
No, Trailing? I just want to say thank you, Mr. Chair, and sure. Just thank you for that. And I apologize for kind of taking us into the basics, but I just think it's important that we not assume that everybody understands what we're talking about here, and thank you for your answer.
Any further discussion to this A1? Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister.
Thank you.
Oh. Representative Dindo, another question for Mr. Gildemeister?
No, that's why I stopped and
further
didn't
discussion.
Follow up. You asked
thank
me if
you.
I had further questions for Mr. Gildemeister.
Okay.
So thank you. And I just wanted to, since now we're talking about the amendment as a whole, I just wanted to say thank you, Representative Elkins, for continuing to push this. You know, half of House File 1487 is in the current omnibus bill. This is basically the other half, and I think it is going to help us make better decisions on our healthcare system in the future. So thank you for pushing this on.
Thank you, Mr. Nadeau. And so we will go ahead. All those in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Next, we'll move to the A2 amendment to the DE. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I move the A2 amendment, and I also would like a roll call on the amendment, please. So we're talking about the big, ugly bill that came out of Republicans in Congress, and people talked a lot at the time about how it cut Medicaid and how it was going to hurt people all over this country. And here's where the rubber meets the road. So we heard from Michelle Benson for the hospitals, and it's great to be on the same side, former Senator Benson, about what this is going to do to people. This is a really big, bad, ugly bill. And the fact that we have to, quote unquote, comply with it does not mean that we should comply with it one more inch than we absolutely have to. And that is what this amendment is about. This amendment is about saying that we're only going to do this as long as we absolutely do have to. And the minute the requirement to have to is gone, these changes are gone. So I know that I've heard Representative Nadeau talking about this bill. I hope I'm not misstating you, Representative Nadeau, but paraphrasing, I guess, that we're doing this because we have to do it. Let's be clear. This bill, this compliance that we're doing here, that is before us, this is going to hurt not only many Minnesotans by kicking them off their health care, but it's going to hurt providers. We have heard from the Hospital Association, this is really serious for hospitals in Minnesota. And if any of you have looked at the data, you know that it's Republicans' districts where where we have the highest percentage of Medicaid patients. This is going to hurt Republican districts and rural health care. And this could be devastating for some. This could close rural hospitals. And this is a Republican bill. You all know this. Republicans in Congress did this. Democrats did not do it. This is a Trump bill with a compliant Republican Congress that passed this thing knowing what it was going to do. And as I said in another committee, they have passed this on to you Republicans here to do their dirty work for them, because this is hurting your own constituents. You own this thing. So since you own it, I would hope that you would join me in making it do the least harm it can do. And that is what these, you're going to hear several amendments, a couple of other members have them, but it's kind of all about the same thing. It's making some changes to the bill before us to try to minimize the harm. Now, one thing I just want to point out, we just heard staff go through the spreadsheet and we heard, you know, it saves some money. It saves some money, so in the tails, we're saving, I think, $198 million. Well, isn't that nice? Guess where that money comes from? It comes right out of your health providers, which, by the way, includes Hennepin County Medical Center. You know, it comes right out of the hide of people who are providing health care, because people who don't have coverage will get sick and they will go to emergency rooms and they will need care, and that care will have to be paid for by somebody, and now the somebody is going to be those hospitals. So this is a really bad bill. The very least we can do is pass this amendment, the A2, that basically says, when we don't have to do this, we're taking it back. We are doing this kicking and screaming because we are being forced to do so. If you don't want to own this and the harm it is going to do to your own constituents, you should be voting for the A2 amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. And a roll call has been requested. Further discussion to the A2. Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. And I, no one appreciates your commitment to the Public Law 119-21, One Big Beautiful Bill, more than I do. Unfortunately, members, this particular amendment has some significant problems, regardless of whether or not we want to stop it immediately upon some change in the future. We will have contract obligations with organizations that will be under contract to provide outreach services, other services. What would happen to the, you know, we're going to have some discussion later about the FTEs that are being added to Department of Human Services to comply with HR 1. Will they immediately lose their jobs at that point because of something like this? You know, triggering bills like this, they're not very common. They happen sometimes, but what would happen if all of a sudden we decide to put a trigger law into a place, a trigger bill like this in place for federal environmental laws? Congress does a lot of things, and there's a lot of things that they do that we don't like. But that's kind of our relationship, you know, good and bad with the federal government. I wish that we were in a different place working on different things, but today we have to do this. And members, this also would basically throw conformity out of place, the governor's position, the House's position. So members, I would recommend that we vote no on this amendment. I'm sorry, Representative Liebling.
Further discussion to the A2 amendment. Seeing none, we will take a roll call vote.
Chair Berman?
Aye.
Co-chair Backer?
No.
Vice Chair Weyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Carroll?
Aye.
Representative DePell?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Franson?
No.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
Yes. No. Yes. Okay.
See, do you want to rethink that?
No, we're good. We get to yes.
Representative Keeler?
Yes.
Representative Knudsen?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Mahmoud?
Aye.
Representative Perriman?
No.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, aye.
Representative Rubinsky?
No.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Van Binsbergen?
No.
Representative Zelensnikar?
No.
Representative Schumacher?
With 11 ayes and 10 nays, one excused the, absent, the amendment is not passed. We'll move on to the A4. Representative Mahmoud, understand you have the A4 to the DE. Would you like to move and explain the amendment, please?
Yes, I'd love to move the A4, Chair. Thank you. This is a very simple amendment to, protect our hospitals and protect our clinics at a time where they are financially struggling. We are looking to make things more difficult for them with this HR 1 bill conformity. So instead of changing the retro coverage to 1 or 2 months, depending on qualifications, we are looking to keep it at the 3 month retro active coverage. It's already included in the forecast, so we're not looking for any additional funding in this amendment. And at a time when HCMC is struggling because of uncompensated care, I don't see how this is a responsible way to move forward. We should be looking at creative ways to protect our hospitals and clinics, increasing access, removing barriers to healthcare coverage. And so I am putting forth this amendment so that we can attempt to do what we can to keep our hospitals as healthy as possible.
Thank you, Representative Mahmoud. On the A4, any further discussion to the amendment? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like a roll call on this as well.
Roll call has been requested.
And thank you. And I would just add that, thank you, Representative Mahmoud, and this is exactly what we just heard testimony about. And just because what this basically does is you keep using state funds for some of the retroactivity, because we're already planning to spend that money. Sometime in the future, maybe we won't be able to afford it. But basically, this goes beyond what the federal requirement is and cuts off retroactive funding to providers in a way that we just don't have to do right now. And as you heard from the podium, from the table there, this is an additional whack to hospitals. So I appreciate the amendment and urge people to vote for it.
For Representative Bonner.
Yeah, I think I just want to kind of double down on that just a little bit, in that, you know, I'm hearing from hospitals in my district from North, which is a much wealthier suburb, but some of the hospitals in our system are struggling. They're struggling a lot. And that's in a better district, in a system that has a little bit more room. But we are actually trying to figure out how to keep our trauma level one hospital intact in Minnesota. Because the hole or the void that that would leave would put an incredible amount of stress on the remaining hospitals, our rural hospitals. What we don't take into account is that Hennepin County Medical Center is not just a regional facility. It is a statewide facility. Patients come from all over the state to go to Hennepin Healthcare. When you fall through the ice in greater Minnesota and you need to get airlifted, you go to Hennepin. If you your kid has an ATV accident and has to come and be airlifted into Hennepin, 40 to 60% of the patients in that facility do not reside in Hennepin County. They're on the verge of collapse. 50% of the staff in the entire state, all of the doctors, the nurses, are educated and trained at that one facility. They are the ones that take all the MA patients that the other hospitals can't afford to take. If they fail, we are now sending those MA patients that are no longer going to be covered for uncompensated care at rural hospitals and hospitals across our state who are already struggling. And by doing this amendment, what we're trying to do is give them just the tiniest bit of relief. Billing is exceptionally difficult and tricky. And trying to do it within a one-month window is asking for miracles in some cases. So we already have a health system that is starting to show strain and looking like it, there are parts of it that are ready to collapse or close. And we want to actually go above and beyond what the feds are asking us to do and make them even more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. This amendment has the ability to actually give them just a tiny bit of relief and keep them just a tiny bit more stable for a little while longer. And frankly, that's our responsibility as legislators to make sure that people across our state are getting the care they need when they need it, and that those facilities that care for them are stable and can continue into the future. I would urge a green vote on this particular amendment.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mahmoud, and to others that have spoken on this. This, unfortunately, this amendment nor the underlying bill doesn't even start to tackle the challenges that we have in reimbursements for our providers. I appreciate the effort, but this amendment is not. It's not simple at all. It's not a simple amendment. Number one, it disregards federal conformity. It ignores the House position, the governor's position. It puts us in a position where we have significant costs that we may lose due to our federal financial participation, and it puts that at risk. And so that is not simple. And so a $15 million or whatever it's pushed in here. And again, you're talking about the expansion population. These are adults without children that the federal government has said there needs to be a minimum component of work required, and the look back has changed. This is a population that the federal government pays 90% of the costs for. So it's not simple, members. I would recommend a no vote on the A4.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair. Just to put some specificity around what hospitals are going to be affected, this morning I happened across an article in my feed that said 7 Minnesota hospitals face closure risk after sweeping federal Medicaid cuts. And these hospitals are Hennepin Healthcare, not surprising, Range Regional Health Services in Hibbing, Lakewood Health System Staples, Mayo Clinic Health System, Albert Lee Austin in Austin, St. Gabriel's Hospital, Little Falls, Lakewood Health Center, Bedette, Manoman Health Center, Manoman. And just think about those communities as you think about opposing this amendment. Thank you.
Co-Chair Becker.
Yeah,
quick here. You know, the reasons that we're facing these challenges in the hospital isn't deal with what we would be hearing today. Everything is around HR1. The challenge that we've had, and this has been an ongoing process, is over the years, we have added more people into medical assistance without the dollars. So there are, like Representative Nadeau, Vice Chair Nadeau said, there are multiple reasons why we have this hiccup. And that's really what we really need to work about. I know that's all important, but this will not solve the reimbursement rates that EMS, hospitals, and others are getting that so low. It's something that we have to work with. So thank you, members. And I would ask to vote no against this amendment, too, members.
I would ask Ms. Benson to come up for a question, please. Thank you. Maybe state your name again for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michelle Benson, Minnesota Hospital Association.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. And I just wanted to follow up on Co-Chair Backer's point there. Hospitals are struggling for a lot of different reasons. And I just wanted to ask about this particular issue, because in your statement, you talked about the importance of this retroactive coverage, how important it is to have the full 90 days due to billing procedures, the timing of trying to get eligibility. And I understand there are so many other factors that are affecting hospitals, but I'm just curious, you're talking to the hospitals across the state, is there any hospital you can think of that would like less than a 90-day retroactive coverage?
Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. Our hospitals will always work towards coverage for our patients. One could argue, you know, it should be extended further to deal with some exceptions, but we have been operating in the existing system, and while technology changes are coming, they haven't proven to be impactful in shortening those timelines. And so as our hospitals look forward to their budgeting season, the more stability and clarity we can have in what our financials will look like going forward, the more helpful it will be to us making operating decisions. So stability is greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. And one more question I have, which you may or may not be able to answer. I know you're pretty up to date on issues around conformity, but this issue of using a 90-day where the state pays part of it in the final 30 days, that does not disregard federal conformity of HR1.
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert on this topic and haven't researched enough to give a certainty to this committee. I apologize. I didn't know that question was going to come before me.
So I'll put, thank you. Thank you for trying. I'll put that to Ms. Mock. Can I ask that question of you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the federal law says that for federal financial participation, retroactive eligibility is the 2 months for most enrollees and then the 1 month for expansion enrollees. It doesn't expressly prohibit the state from having other retroactive eligibility periods.
My understanding it was, thank you for that answer, but my understanding it was a state option, and it's not going to be a red flag with the federal government over our conformity of HR1. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I can directly answer that. I can just say again that it's not expressly prohibited to have a different retroactive period.
Very good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Seeing no other questions at this time, we will take a vote.
Chair Bierman?
Aye.
Chair Backer?
No.
Vice Chair Weyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Carroll?
Aye.
Representative DePell?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Franson?
No.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Keeler?
Yes.
Representative Knutson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Mahmoud?
Aye.
Representative Perriman?
No.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, aye.
Representative Rubinsky?
No.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Van Bisbergen?
No.
Representative Zelensnikar?
No.
We have 11 ayes, 10 noes, 1 abstention, and the A4 is not adopted. Representative Lee, I understand you have the A5 amendment to the DE.
Yes, Chair. This one is very straightforward. In terms of the cost sharing, October 2028 seems just arbitrary and unnecessary. So let's just take it out. A lot of things are going to change in the next 2.5 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee.
Oh, and roll call.
A roll call has been called. And further discussion to the A5. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this. And, you know, we've had in this committee in the past a lot of discussion about this so-called cost sharing, which I think that's a euphemism if there ever was one, cost sharing. So we got rid of that in Minnesota, and we got rid of it not because, well, for a number of reasons. We got rid of the so-called cost sharing. One of the big reasons is that the providers are collecting it from people, and it's really small dollars. And if the person can't pay, they just have to eat it. So it's really, you know, it's not only asking people who are desperately low income to come up with money to pay for their, you know, a few bucks to come up with this and that, their drugs and whatever else. It's in the bill that it'll tell you what it is. But it's asking the providers to have to deal with this and try to collect and then essentially eat the cost. So again, you're dumping more costs onto your providers by doing this cost-sharing thing, which is not necessary. As Representative Lee said, we're doing something we don't have to do. When we have to, okay, then we'll do it. Then we'll join you in voting for this terrible stuff because we have to do it, quote unquote. But why should we do it ahead of time and put our providers at more risk? It just doesn't make any sense. And the dollars on the sheet are just really small. This is not like big money stuff, but it does, you know, it's just one more stone on the back of the wagon, you know, and pretty soon the axle is going to break. So I really recommend that folks vote yes on this, and let's wait until we have to before we make our providers gather these few bucks and account for them and fill in what doesn't get paid.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Lee, for bringing this forward. I'll speak as a person who has been objectively poor and on medical assistance, and because I often hear people say, well, it's only $3, it's only $3.50, it's only $10 for a script. When you are barely able to feed your kid, when you are barely able to keep them clothed, keep gas in the car, keep doing what you need to do, there's no such thing as just a few dollars. So I echo Chair Liebling's comments about why would we do this sooner. But for the grand total of $411,000, if we had people who were paying $3 for a care experience, 137,000 interactions with a care provider would occur, 137,000 opportunities for stress and pressure on people. And I know that there would be a healthy portion, no pun intended, of people who would forego care because that's what happens. And then they'll be in your emergency rooms.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee. And I feel it's interesting to sit here and defend the governor's bill, but apparently I am. This was not in in my conformity bill. But I want to remind the committee that, again, this is talking about the expansion population. You know, these are adults without kids, above 100% of the federal poverty guideline, and they're paying $3. Now, I opposed the elimination of cost-sharing bill when we did it, I think, in 2023. I think people want to be part of their healthcare experience. I had a little talk not too long ago in front of a group, and you know, I asked the group how many people were on Medicaid, how many people were on Medicare, how many people went to the MNsure, how many people had employer insurance, and you know, they all raised their hands when they said they had employer insurance. I said, how many people know what percent of their premium that they pay? Members, not one person raised their hand. Part of the problem that we have in our healthcare system in America and in Minnesota is that people don't value the investments that our healthcare system makes in their health. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to sit here and say that somebody, it's not worth $3 or $3.50 for a non-emergency visit to a hospital-based emergency room, $3 for a brand name drug description, $1 for a generic drug. Members, just vote no.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. You know, I think when we talk all this session about affordability, what we just said here, I don't even know what to say to that, right? If you can't feed your kids and you don't have the $3 to afford your prescription, well, then tough. Just deal with it. I'm sorry you can't afford the $3. Is that really what we want to say to people who are struggling with affordability issues at this time, when it's getting harder and harder to afford things? And let's be very clear about what this means. If you don't pay the $3 and they don't pick up their prescription and they don't get their medicine, and they get sick again, and they end up in an emergency room, who's going to pay the bill? Guess who's paying it? You are. Taxpayers. We pay when those things don't get covered. We pay for the additional visit. And I can guarantee you the next visit to the emergency room is going to cost a lot more than $3. So let's be very honest. It's penny wise, pound foolish. $3 is a hell of a lot cheaper than a couple $100s or a couple $1,000s that drives up the cost of healthcare for every single person in this room, for every one of our Minnesota taxpayers. Vote yes.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. And I my colleague is very passionate about this, and I'm going to kind of rebuttal her a little bit on some of this. From working in an emergency room and working with many of these people that are that don't have the $3 in their pocket or the dollar in their pocket, you know, and it's not just the able people that do this, it's the seniors that are also going to be caught up in this, that come to the ER or yet want to go to the ER but don't want to spend the $3, they're from a different generation. And they would benefit greatly by going to the ER or going to a clinic, but, you know, is it that or am I going to buy my ramen noodles? And it really, I mean, these are real situations. I've been caught up in these. 99.9% of the time, if they must pay the $3, the healthcare provider gets out of their purse and gives it to them. That's what happens. And it's no different than Representative Bonner saying this, but I'm going to kind of go back. Yep, eventually we all pay for health care losses. That's the way it goes. We get our premiums raised, all these other things happen. But what really happens, and we're seeing it at Hennepin County right now, we're seeing it at other places around the state, which Vice Chair Ryer just read off a number of them. It hits the people that work in these institutions first. Number one, it goes to them first because they have to either cut staff, they have to either not get a raise, they either have to cut benefits. And when healthcare services, it has its own economy in it, and that's where it comes out. Eventually, because the hospitals have to try to get more out of the payers and stuff, yep, then that's when the general public gets it. But there's no account here. We're arguing about this right here. This doesn't come out of our pockets today. It comes out of the people at Hennepin County Medical Center and the ones worried about having a job in 3 months. That's whose pocket this comes out of right now as we're actively speaking. I'm looking for this account where everybody thinks that we at the state pay for charity care. We do not. It comes directly out of the people that work in these hospitals from the CEO down to the housekeeper. And then when it gets to us, it's almost too late, which we're experiencing today. So I want to make us really reset on some of this. These are all good amendments because I get it. I get it that there's a time for change. There's a time we have to do certain things. And Washington's in charge right now. But I think we got to put ourselves in check. $3 is a lot of money to a lot of people. And we all saw the financial reports that came out of the state the other day. We're starting to see a slump here. Marlene Marshall just testified in the Senate and talked about how it's not just one hospital, it's several, and she expects more. So, I mean, we're in a crisis here, and $3? Really? We have a wave coming at us, so I'm sorry. I guess I'm as emotional as you are, Representative Becker.
All right, I will take, we'll take one more members' question or thoughts, and then we are going to go to the vote. We have two more amendments to go. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I just want to remind the body and the public that Democrats didn't think it was a big deal to raise gas taxes, which would be more than $3. Democrats didn't mind raising car tabs. That was more than $3. They didn't mind raising the sales tax, which was more than $3. And Democrats complaining about affordability when they spent 2 years raising the cost of everything is a joke. So you can spare me your fake outrage for the public. Thank you.
The clerk will take the roll. And the chair votes aye.
Chair Backer?
No.
Vice Chair Ryer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Carroll?
Aye.
Representative DePauw?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Franson?
No.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
Yes.
Representative Keeler?
Yes.
Representative Knudsen?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Mahmoud?
Aye.
Representative Perriman?
No.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, aye.
Representative Rubinsky?
No.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Van Binsbergen?
No.
Representative Zelensnikar?
No.
So 11 ayes, 10 nays. The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Liebling, the A6 amendment.
Yeah.
You will move adoption of the A6?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move adoption of the A6. And again, I would request a roll call on the amendment.
Roll call is noted.
And so the A6 and so the A6 does a number of things. It, again, this amendment is about reducing harm to Minnesotans. So as this bill has to be implemented, we want to do it in a way that complies while doing the least harm to the people who are on Medicaid. And so one of the things that this amendment does is it addresses the issue of frailty, and we heard some testimony about that. It fixes, in the underlying bill, there's a 45-day period. Let me see if I can get this right here. I should look it up in the amendment just to help me out here. There's, for example, if you look, we're talking about exclusions from the time for having to comply with the work requirement. And what the underlying bill does is it has a 45-day period in which you have to be in compliance, and that is more than the federal requirement, which is 1 month. So this fixes that. So it brings it, in other words, puts less burden on Minnesotans and still meets the federal requirement. The current bill goes beyond that. And then it also has some consumer protections in it. And then one little piece that's added in this amendment is we heard about the Minnesota Care exclusion. I think someone mentioned this from the table up here earlier. And that is something in the bill that says that if you are bumped off of Medicaid because you don't comply with the work requirements, you're not eligible for Minnesota Care. Well, that is a completely unnecessary, gratuitous thing to have in there now, because right now you wouldn't be eligible anyway. So all that does is really preclude any future change. I mean, we can always change it back, I suppose, but there's really no reason to be doing that. It's another kind of thumb in the eye that the bill is doing, which is just completely unnecessary and actually meaningless. So that's what the amendment does. And I do want to say that this amendment and other amendments here that you've heard today physically write them, of course. You know, nonpartisan staff did the amendment. But, I mean, the amendments came to me with help from legal aid. And so we do have folks here that can answer questions about it. This one has a number of things in it, and if I didn't cover them all, we could call up someone who could help us answer some questions. But that's basically what this amendment is doing. It's kind of cleaning up a number of things, trying to reduce harm to Minnesotans that this bill is going to cause. So let's do the least harm we can. And adopt this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And at this time, I'd ask someone from DHS to come forward, either Ms. Bailey or Ms. Grom, for a question regarding this item in HR1 that has a 30-day minimum, is my understanding. And this is at 45, and I just wondered if you could comment on the issue of going to 45 days, which isn't really an option that's listed from my understanding, and I just wanted the department's thoughts on a 45-day and any issues that would have in compliance or in facilitation.
Sure, Chair Bierman, members, Elise Bailey, Budget Director at the Department of Human Services. Yes, we are not certain that we would be able to implement a 45-day look-back period. What the federal law says is that for applicants, for example, they have to meet it for one or more, but not more than 3 consecutive months. And that, to us, measures time in periods of months, not days. So we feel, just our quick reading of a 45-day period, that it isn't something that is specified in the federal guidance or the federal law. They measure it in increments of months. We haven't heard any guidance or anything to the effect that they would be measured in days. The other thing, I think even maybe more importantly, is that implementation and operationalizing a look-back period that is a random 45-day period in the last 6 months, for example, would be challenging, if not impossible, for us to have the systems and capacity to effectively implement this provision.
Thank you for those comments. And if you could just hang tight while we have any further discussion, just in case. Further discussion to the A6. Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Liebling. This is an interesting approach for sure. So I'm going to, since the department's up there, so the system hasn't been built. So when you say that you don't know if your system could look back at, you know, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, that which is what the federal government allows, it's one up to three. And we're talking about two different things here, initial certification and then recertification. And so just to remind everyone that, you know, the underlying bill has 45 days or 1.5 months, however we want to word it, you know, contiguous. And then for recertification, if someone has, it's 1.5 months of either work or volunteering in the past 6 months. So the system's not built. So my question is, if the system's not built, are you fairly certain that you couldn't build that system?
Ms. Bailey.
Chair Bierman, Representative Nadeau. Our initial read is that would be incredibly complex. Would we have to look at the wages for every single day in that six-month period and decide, oh, Monday, November 1st through whatever the 45-day market, oh, they technically meet it in that 45-day period, rather than looking at it in a clean fashion of monthly periods. I just think it would be incredibly complex, and we would have to go to the drawing board in terms of whether our systems would have capacity to do it on a daily basis.
Follow up?
Oh, yeah. We got a lot to talk about in this amendment, Mr. Chair. So thank you. I appreciate that. I don't agree with it, and I think that DHS and Minute and all of the partners that are going to have to come together to comply with this, which is significant. I mean, you guys are getting 65 FTEs to become compliant for HR1. That is a significant investment, and the charge that we're being faced with is also significant. So I think it's possible to do. But back to the underlying amendment, I was very intrigued by the applicable individual. That's an interesting way. I'm not quite sure how that fits in. It's very new. It's very different from what we've done. But more importantly, and members, if this were something that were brought up maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think it would be something that we could have possibly looked at. But you know, one of the biggest things that we're looking at, self-attestation of work or volunteering, that does not conform to the federal. You don't get to say, nope, on my honor, I did it. I volunteered. I was over there. You don't get to do that. And so, members, like I say, Representative Liebling, if this was brought up a little earlier, it would have been interesting to look at how we could have done something like this. But the federal, the HR1 is very concise in what the exemptions are and what the work requirements are. We drafted this bill, and the governor concurred in his. In the same fashion. So with that, members, I would recommend a no vote on this amendment.
Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just to say, first of all, the fact that this bill is rushed, boy, I don't own that one. This bill was posted yesterday, and there wasn't even a deadline or anything about amendments. I mean, I made staff work all night to get this thing ready. You know, I mean, just to have any amendments here, to even have a discussion about it. We barely had any discussion about this bill that's going to crash our whole system, possibly, because of what they did in Congress. Without much thought, they rushed that one through for sure, you know, over a lot of objection to which they didn't listen. Mm-hmm. So, and I just do want to say to Representative Nadeau, you know, you've made several references to the governor. Well, I want to tell you that we're a separate branch of government here. We are not like Republicans in Congress who follow their crazy president over a cliff. We do not do that here. Mm. If we don't agree with something that comes from the governor, we don't agree with it. It's not a party thing. It's a matter of you paying attention to what you're doing to your constituents. So don't tell me, oh, well, the governor did it, therefore. You know, we don't work that way here, I hope. And if we do, we should stop. Because that is not how we work. And I don't think members on our side do work that way, as a matter of fact. You know, we listen to what the governor has to say. We respect him as a person. And we respect what he's trying to do. And we try to examine the points and we make our decisions. So, you know, that's not the issue. So, you know, this is certainly not at the end of its path, this bill. There's more work that's going to be done here. There's obviously got to be some conferencing with the Senate. There's going to be some more consideration of all of these things. And, you know, you say that this doesn't comply with H.R. 1, and I say it does. I've been told that it does, and that's why I'm putting it forward. I'm not trying to put forward something that I don't think complies. So, you know, that can, if it doesn't, you know, I think there's even some other work going on here around the self-attestation, that if that turns out, you know, we don't even have guidance from the feds on this. There are still things they haven't even told us. Talk about, you know, are we rushing? I think we should actually wait till they tell us what we have to comply with. And here we're trying to figure it out on the fly. So, you know, I completely reject the thing, oh, it's too late, we should have thought about this before. No, I think we should adopt this, and then we can go forward. This does less harm to Minnesotans, as I said, and less harm to our hospitals, less harm to our healthcare system. And if it turns out that some of the things in here won't fly, well, then we'll fix them. How about that? Because your bill does the same thing. You don't know. Some of the stuff, we don't know what's going to happen and what they're going to say, you know, at the end of the day. So members should vote yes on this amendment.
Thank you. And the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes yes.
Chair Backer?
No.
Vice Chair Royer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
Absolutely not.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Carroll?
Aye.
Representative DePauw?
No.
Representative Elkins? Representative Franson?
No.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Keeler?
Yes.
Representative Knudsen?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Absolutely yes.
Representative Mahmoud?
Yes.
Representative Perriman?
No.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, aye.
Representative Rubinsky?
No.
Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Representative Vance Binsbergen?
No.
Representative Zelensky-Carr?
Zelensky-Carr, no.
Aye. 11 ayes, 11 noes. The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. I'm not aware of any more amendments, so I renew the motion to adopt the DE1 amendment as amended. Any discussion? All right. We will adopt the DE on a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and the DE1 amendment is amended as adopted. So we are up to the motion that the House File 4466 be referred to Ways and Means Committee. And we had a motion for a roll call. So we will go to the roll call. Okay. I'll renew the motion that the House File 4466 as amended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Berman?
Aye.
Chair Backer?
We voice voted that.
No, we did the DE.
Oh, thank you. Sorry.
Yes. So sorry. Thank you. Members, this is final passage of the bill.
This is final passage of the bill, as Chair Berman has said, and I vote aye.
We did roll call it.
I think we did. I thought we had a roll call at the very beginning for the final passage.
It was never up. That was for the DE1.
All right. I'll call a roll call for the bill.
Chair Bierman?
Aye.
Chair Backer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ryer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Carroll?
Aye.
Representative DePaul?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Franson?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Keeler?
No.
Representative Knudsen?
Yes.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Perriman?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Rubinsky?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Representative Van Binsbergen?
Yes.
Representative Zelensnikar?
Zelensnikar, aye.
Representative Bonner?
Bonner changes from aye to nay.
Bonner changes from aye to nay. Rep. Carroll?
Thank you. I change to nay as well.
Rep. Carroll changes from aye to nay. 14 ayes, 8 nays. The motion prevails. And then the House File 4466, as amended, is referred to the Ways and Means Committee, and we direct nonpartisan staff to make any technical or clarifying changes to the bill to reflect the intent of the committee. Members, our adjournment is here. This concludes the business for the day. We're only 3 minutes behind, so committee is adjourned. Thank you.